here on a highway turned into a lake. Born on this planet that I didn't make. The ice caps are melting, you can measure the rise of the poisoned oceans, hear all the lies of the political pundits and corporate crooks. They're accountants and scientists cooking the books with hardly an inkling of what it's about. Wedded to profit in flood and in drought, I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world.
We are learning by experience how destructive an industrial civilization can be. An industrial civilization is not a healthy civilization. You will never have health, either health of mind or physical health, or health of individuals or groups. In an industrial world that's based on exploiting the planet.
Here in the city, shrouded in smoke, 10 million people this morning awoke to a future of cancer, industrial disease. So let's build some more suburbs and buy SUVs. Cut down the mountains, burn all the coal, and put all the
Well, the way to look at it is to have our human technologies that are coherent with Earth technologies. It's the coherence that is the proper interplay and the mutual interaction that fosters both the natural systems and the human systems. That's the basic idea, to work out patterns of interaction where the human and the natural interact creatively with each other. As I said, we need a mode of human presence that's a mutually beneficial mode of human presence on the planet Earth.
Here in this war zone called land, water, and air, I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world. I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world.
The human has been trying to establish a human governance out of its own needs or its own functioning. But in reality, human governance is a function of the universe, particularly the planet Earth. So the planet Earth is the unit of governance. Now the ecology issue emerges from the fact that humans have been constructing a government of humans, for humans, by humans, and with its destiny developing the human. But that won't work, because if the human is looking for its own benefit, rather than the benefit of the larger community, as we become predators on the natural community, then we lose in every way. And that's why I say sometimes that the American Constitution is a perfect prescription for destroying the planet. Why? Because it gives all the rights to the human, and it authorizes the human, the American Constitution particularly, to exploit the planet. To own property and to use the property, the use relationship, and that's a disastrous relationship of humans with the planet, to have it based on use rather than presence and mutual presence to each other. So if we build our legislation on the benefit of the human to and the rights of the human to exploit the planet, then we're bound to end up in a catastrophic situation.
Now, I would like to give some idea of where we are. A person says, where are we? What are we to do? We are at the end of the Cenozoic period in the story of the Earth. What is happening now is not simply another historical change or cultural modification. We frequently tell the history of the classical period and the movement from classical civilization to medieval to Renaissance to industrial age. That is totally inadequate. It is totally false in its overall impression. If we think that what's happening now, that the transition now, is in that sequence, simply in that sequence of transformations. Something vastly different is happening. We're changing the chemistry of the planet. We're changing the biosystems of the planet in a deleterious way. We are changing the planet on a scale of hundreds of millions of years in a single decade or a few decades. We are wiping out the rainforest that took 60 million years to bring into existence, but we are destroying at the rate of an acre a second. It's even more than that. It's something the size of a football field every second is being lost. And the rainforest carries probably something like half of the species, of the living species of the planet are there. It's certainly the greatest concentration of life anywhere in the universe that we know about, that is, the planet Earth. And so it's, in a way, certainly among the most beautiful thing in creation, extinguishing it for seconds.
The story of the Earth is a very long story, and it's told very eloquently in a book called The Universe Story, written by Thomas Berry and Brian Swim. And it's a story which has been told in many languages. It's a story which is told essentially in creation stories in various religious disciplines. It's also told in scientific language. And I'm not too concerned about the particular mode that one uses to describe the story, but I'll use this primarily scientific language. Essentially, as far as we know, for some mysterious reason, out of the void came the Big Bang, and there was this huge explosion which sent energy and matter rocketing out into the void. And gradually, over time, something amazing happened. That seemingly random movement of energy began to organize itself, and a process of creativity was set in motion which continues to this day. So the stars formed, and one of the stars that formed was a huge star called Tiamat. And Tiamat eventually went supernova and created elements and matter which were eventually spun into our solar system with the planets around it. And one of those planets, Earth, was particularly significant, and we have yet to find a planet as unique and special as Earth in the universe. And through a combination of factors to do with the size of Earth, its proximity to the sun, etc., it was possible for one to have gases, liquids and solids coexisting, you had the formation of the oceans, the continents forming, and out of this sort of chemical soup, life emerged. And that life diversified steadily and grew in complexity. From time to time, it had major setbacks, and there were periods of mass extinction, and five, in fact, so far. And unfortunately, we're now in the early stages of the sixth period of mass extinction, the last being 15 million years ago, which saw, we think, the demise of the dinosaurs. But the difference now is that two points I think are central to this. The one is we are absolutely part of this Earth story. There is no question of human beings being separate from the system which has given rise to us. Every part of us is shaped by this evolutionary process. If gravity on Earth was slightly different, our limbs would be different. We are nourished by other members of the community. Everything we eat comes from another member of the community, plants, animals, etc. Our minds and our understandings are shaped by by the beauty of the universe, the magnitude of the universe, our experiences. We are quintessentially Earthlings. We are, if you like, more a manifestation, a particular form of this Earth, or if you like, of the spiritual creative force that lies behind the Earth, than something which is entirely separate. Now we found ourselves in a situation where the great transformations which have occurred previously have been the result of natural forces, but now our ability as a single species to transform this Earth has become so powerful and so extensive that we are effectively playing the role of a force of nature. So for example, while the evolution of species for millennia has been determined by a natural selection, we believe, now whether or not a species lives or dies is not really going to be up to natural selection. It's pretty much dependent on human decision making. So with that, and we are changing the composition of the Earth, we're changing the basic life support structures and the functioning of those processes. And with that enormous power should come a concomitant responsibility to use that power wisely. But the fact is, like it or not, we are now, the Earth is in a process of radical change. We know about climate change, but in many other areas as well, particularly extinctions. The rate of extinctions now, anthropogenic human-caused extinctions, hasn't been seen for 15 million years since we think a meteorite smashed into the Earth. And we are now in the early stages of that period of extinction. So it's very hard to overestimate, to overstate the magnitude of the change that we're talking about. This has been achieved, or this has come about to some extent, because of 16th and 17th century ideas of people like Bacon, Descartes, and Newton, who essentially understood the world as a vast machine, a very mechanistic understanding of the world, and which placed a great emphasis on the difference between mind and matter, if you like, the spirit and the material world. And what has since happened, of course, is that science has moved on an awful lot since Newtonian days, and scientists don't understand the world like that anymore. What we now understand is that this is not a big machine made of cogs, and you just need to study each cog to understand how it works. What we're talking about here is what's important is the relationship between the bits. So the world or the universe is better understood as a kind of vast whirling celebratory dance. Because the thing about a dance is not the dancer, it's not the music, it's not even the steps. The dance is the relationship between all of them. And that gives one perhaps a better sense of how the world functions. And also we are inherent participants in the dance. You know, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle point demonstrated that as soon as one asks a question, one's trying to find something, the act of asking that question, whether it's a speed or mass of an electron, influences the result. So we are an integral part of this whole system. But unfortunately, our legal systems are still based on this mechanistic understanding of the world, where there are human beings which are the subjects, and everything else is defined as an object. And an object is clearly, by definition, incapable of holding rights. Also, if one thinks of the situation where some people were once defined as objects, in other words, as slaves, one can clearly see that it's not possible to have a healthy relationship between a slave owner and a slave. That relationship is inherently exploitative by virtue of the legal position of the slave, which is viewed as an object owned by the slave owner and incapable of having rights. And yet that is precisely the relationship that we have established in relation to the rest of the world. We have become completely autistic in relation to the natural world. If in law schools, any law school that I've been in, everything you needed to know was in the law library. There was nothing higher than the Constitution. There was no need at all to refer to anything in the natural world. The concept of human beings being part of a wider sense of natural order, of us being a subcomponent of a great system of order in the universe, has been lost.
Sometimes suggest that we are reinventing the human. I have a sentence that goes something like this. The historical mission of our times is to reinvent the human at the species level, with critical reflection within the community of life systems in a time developmental context by means of story and shared dream experience. The most important thing of all of this is the shared dream experience. Life is dreamed. We're not going to be able to work out all the mechanics. Mechanics of it will come in time. But we have to have the dream first, before anything. I think, as Carl Jung said, and I repeat it endlessly, that the dream drives the action. But the dream not only drives the action, the dream guides the action. It's our dreams that are most important. If we consider how we got into our present situation, it's very simple. We dreamed something, and that dream turned into a pathology. It was a dream of a glorious world. I generally relate it to the most traumatic experience of Western civilization, which probably would be the Black Death. The plague that struck the Western world, or the European world, in 1347. Between that time and 1349, perhaps a third of Europe died. You can imagine a third of Europe dying. Half the people of Florence, I believe, died in 3 months. It was an extraordinary stroke, and I don't like to trace monumental historical changes to any single incident. But this was a terrifying thing, particularly because they had absolutely no explanation. They had no idea of germs. They didn't have any way of explaining this. And of course, we always generally go to moral explanations that the earth was somehow wicked, or had become wicked, and the humans had become unworthy, and so God was punishing. Now this sense of punishment, it reflected itself in the preaching. For the first time, Christians began to preach a spiritual revival based on four things: death, judgment, heaven, hell. The morality plays were built on this, the everyman play, which the only thing that's worthwhile looking for in life is what you take with you when you die. And the only thing you take with you are your virtues. So so, property, everything in the temple order becomes evanescent, in a certain sense, unreal. And so there was an element of what a person might call escape out of the world, and to be redeemed out of the world, rather than to learn how to live effectively and magnificently and a sacred life in the world. And this was the time, and then a little later, over against the religious redemption view, and this hit the 15th century particularly, is the time when the dance of death was developed. Also, Ars Moriendi, the art of dying, was developed in the 15th century. There's some 40-some texts of this, the art of dying, and then the morality plays were built in on this and so forth. So, this was a psychic trauma, you might say, in the Western mind. A little later, the scientific development took place. So rather than deal with this by redemption out of the world, and Francis Bacon particularly proposed that we learn to control the world. Control it. Let's investigate it. Torture nature. He uses that to torture nature, to give up its secrets so that we could control the world. And from then on, the sciences and technologies began to be invented, and the dream of a wonder world that we could achieve, we could transform this world and realize the millennial expectation of the biblical world, we could do it by our sense of control of the world, and that was what it was to be human. And so we entered on to this dynamism of control, and that's why even science at the present time, or in recent times, is inseparable from technology. It's the drive toward technological controls that have developed, but at the end of it, like all advertising, I think, is millennial vision. It's this vision of a world that we can make if we just learn how to manipulate things. So that turned into the dream that drives our industrial world. And even this is the dream of Wonder World. It's a Disney dream. Actually, right now, the incarnation of this dream is Disney World. The more we learn to manipulate, the more we turn the world into Disneyland. And that's a kind of an ideal. But while this Wonder World is being is driving us to these controls, we're really making Waste World. So, but our attention is focused on Wonder World. Don't think about the Waste World, Wonder World. Now the ecologists begin to see the Waste World, and it can't get the rest of people to recognize that there is such a thing as Waste World, that the Wonder World is an illusory dream. Now, so we come to this question of the dream. We need to dream of a time when humans would be present to the world, to the planet, in a mutually enhancing manner. Not to make Wonder World, to accept, but above all, it has to be a dream within the context in which life is granted us. Life is granted us within limits. And we have to dream and guide our actions within those limits. There is this idea that we can do anything, we can do this, so if we can do it, do it. Well, we don't consult the earth. How do we function?
The shift that I'm talking about, I sometimes refer to as a shift of Copernican magnitude. Because in the same way as Copernicus pointed out that the Earth revolves around the Sun and not the other way around, we have to make a similar shift. Earth jurisprudence requires us to stand the legal universe on its head and to point out that legal systems can no longer be centered on what the dominant classes in human society want, but instead must revolve around and be shaped by the laws of the universe and the Earth community in particular. This, in a way, is still the same battle that was being fought in Copernicus's time. The reason why the authorities of the day clamped down on Galileo and Copernicus was not so much because of the physics. I mean, let's face it, the sun, the Earth has always moved around the sun, and nothing actually changed if one accepts that perspective. All that's changed is an acceptance of a reality which already existed. But what the authorities objected to was the shift, moving humans away from the center of the universe, because the power structures of the day and a lot of the orthodoxies rested on the fact that human beings were at the center of the Earth and the Earth was at the center of the universe and everything literally revolved around us. Now, of course, since then, we've given ground on the physics, but we still cling tenaciously to the idea that human beings are at the center of the universe and that everything must revolve around us. And quite frankly, that is patently false, whether one approaches it from a scientific perspective or any other perspective, in my view. And the shift that I'm talking about seems as radical as a Copernican shift, in the sense that it's a very big conceptual shift, but like the Copernican shift, it's simply a recognition of a pre-existing reality, in my view. In other words, what Copernicus and Galileo were doing was pointing out, were giving people a reality check, saying, whatever you may believe, that's not in fact how it works. And I think that's what we've been talking about here.
As regards the community, the human community at the present time, we didn't choose to be here. That is, to be alive at the end of the 20th century. We were put here. We were brought into being independently of any decision any of us made. We are a generation of destiny. And this responsibility brings with it the support of the whole cosmological order that brought us here in the first place. I call it the grace of the moment. Not exactly in a religious sense, but in a meta-religious sense. In a sense that it's a cosmological sense. The universe knows how to run itself. Planet Earth knows how to run itself. And the planet Earth chose us to be here at this time. There were other forces that went into the process that brought us here. But ultimately, it's the Earth that brought us here. And the Earth gives us the guidance that we need, it gives us the support that we need, and we don't need to feel that we are alone. The trees are for us. The air is for us, the water is for us, all things are for us. And we need to be able to feel and experience the support. And we look out at the sound here and the water and the waves. They're speaking to us, addressing us, and telling us about themselves, and asking us to establish a rapport with them. The trees speak, the wind speaks, the sky speaks, the sun and the moon. All of these speak to us. But we've got to develop the capacity to hear. Listen. What are the trees saying? What do you hear?